Welcome, listeners, to another bonus episode of the Oh My Word podcast. And today, special guest that we have with us, debut author. Her book is not even out yet, and we're having her on the podcast already. So you heard it here first, folks. And if you heard it somewhere else, just pretend like you heard it here first. So we would like to welcome, put your hands together, Cassie Gustafson. Did I get that correct? Welcome to our program. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Esther. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, well, we're thrilled to have you. And just for everyone to know, Cassie's book is coming out next year. Or actually, what month is it coming out? Is it even a year already that your book's going to be coming out?
It is, yes. It'll be forthcoming July 2021.
Less than a year already. Less than a year for Cassie's book, After the Ink Dries.
Yep.
After the Ink Dries. And we'll get it. I know you have so many questions, but hang on, people. Just hang on. So let's start from the beginning like we always do. Cassie, how do you get from the point of just meandering around your life to, I got a book coming out next year? How did we get here?
That is a long answer, but I'll try to be as succinct as possible. So writing isn't something that I've always done all my life. You often hear authors say that they've been scribbling down stories since they were wee little things and such, but that wasn't me. I found my way to it much later. I guess for me, at least for a long time, I feel like I deeply feared being bad at anything, and I often quit something before I even started it. I was such a wild perfectionist that I couldn't hold out for the possibility of success, if that makes any sense. In 2008, I graduated from my university with a dual bachelor's in Spanish language and literature and comparative literature. So I knew that I loved stories and I loved language, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And of course, that was the year that the economy took a total nosedive.
Yeah.
So I was doing things like, I worked as a preschool teacher for a year. I worked in retail clothing. I worked in a greenhouse tending lavender and tomato plants. And I worked as a nanny for some really great families. But I knew it wasn't the career or the purpose that I was searching for.
Yeah.
And then came somewhere around 2013. I was living in LA at the time, and I don't honestly know what pushed me into being brave, but finally, sometime around then, this story popped into my head. And it was middle grade before I even knew the word for middle grade. And it was about this young boy who moved to a new town with his mother after his father passes away. And of course, unbeknownst to him, the house he moves into is haunted and bum, 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 you know, ghostly chaos ensues.
Right.
But for whatever reason, something allowed me to write this story down and to, you know, just be bad at something for a while. And I wrote this story. I didn't really know what to do with it. So I searched online for a writing group and I looked on Meetup, and at that point, I found the Children's Book Writers of Los Angeles, which is a group that my now friend, Nichelle, started.
Oh.
And I didn't know her at the time, and I went to my first meeting, which was a writing critique group, and I was scared out of my mind, but I shared my story. And everyone there was just so kind and encouraging from the very start, and I'll never forget it, that my friend Nichelle, who wasn't my friend at the time, I just knew her as this woman, you know, running this critique. She pulled me aside afterwards, and I think we were meeting in a library, and she said, "The voice in this story is amazing, and you have such talent, and keep writing." And
awesome.
It genuinely just blew me away. I sometimes wonder if that wouldn't have happened, or if the group had been mean or really critical or whatever else, if I would have kept writing. And had the confidence to keep going. But, you know, because she was so kind and the whole group was so kind, that it really gave me the courage to keep going. But at the same time, I knew I had so much to learn about writing. I knew that this was an interest and that I felt this spark of something every time that I wrote. And so with the encouragement of my amazing, supportive husband, Carl, I applied to grad school to write. And I told myself it, at the time, that it was so I could be an English professor and then I would write on the side.
Right.
But of course, you know, that's not what ended up happening. And I ended up attending two programs. So during the fall and the spring semester, I would go to Cal State Fullerton, where I was studying literature. Specifically, my emphasis was in trauma literature, how trauma is represented and written about in books. And then during the summer, I'd fly out to Virginia to attend Collins University. It's renowned for its children's literature program. And I just really found a home there with these incredible other writers and professors, and it taught me so much. And, you know, on top of that, I became a member of SCBWI and learned a tremendous amount from the business side of everything. And then I also ended up joining the board of directors for the Children's Book Writers of Los Angeles, which was the very same group that I had that first critique at. So,
oh, nice.
I waited my whole life to find something that I really, really felt passionate about. And when I found it, I just jumped into it. And then about halfway through my program, I realized I didn't want to teach. I wanted to write. And so my shift and my focus and all of my classwork and everything really went in that direction. So it's a very long answer to how I got into writing, but this is all to say, be brave and try new things and listen to where life is trying to take you, because it often leads to beautiful places full of possibility.
Right, yeah, amen. So it sounds like, though, just to go back a second, that you originally graduated with a degree in literature. So were you always an avid reader? Was that something, you said you always loved stories. So were you always a reader, but you never thought you would ever be good enough to be a writer?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Right. I grew up in Southern California until about sixth grade. And I have these very vivid memories of going to the libraries in Redondo and Torrance and all of these areas, and filling out those summer reading lists with, like, you know, violent fervor of,
yes,
I will read all of the books.
Right.
And, you know, just getting such joy from libraries and from reading and from new stories. And yeah, I really credit my mom for that, for giving me that love of reading.
Oh, amazing. Well, do you look back now and the different kind of the detours that you took on your way to becoming a writer, there's an experience there that I can at least draw on for writing, or is it just, well, that was that part of life and now we're on to another part of life? Or have you even thought about that?
Which parts do you mean?
As far as being a preschool teacher or a nanny or tending tomatoes in a greenhouse or any of those things, because, you know, they always say that to be a writer, it's not, you got to live life also to be able to write it. But the things that you described are not what's in your upcoming novel. So, I mean, maybe they did make their way in. But that doesn't mean, because even as a preschool teacher, you can watch as children develop. And that might teach you something just about people, maybe. Or if you had to deal with moms and dads, that could teach you something. Maybe that taught you something that you could draw upon. Or have you not gotten to that, like, that level yet? We're like, oh, I need to start drawing on these. See how I could cross-reference life experiences with writing.
I feel like, absolutely, I feel like every experience that I've had somehow makes its way into my writing. And I don't mean, like, if I go to the grocery store, then I'm going to write about going to the grocery store. But I mean that little tiny interactions, little nuances of people, ways that the world works and operates and moves, I feel like all of those things go into writing. So I would say, absolutely, my experiences all sort of led me to this path, both, you know, sometimes meandering, but sometimes very directly. Yeah,
right.
For sure.
Right. So now here's that original story that you wrote, the middle grade story. What happened to that? Because is that story somewhere now, or is that more just your springboard story that allowed you to try writing?
It's middle grade, and right now my focus is really YA, but I think about going back to it. You know, I have a probably, I don't know, half of a novel there. But what was interesting to me is I wrote it from the point of view of this boy who moves into town. And I didn't realize until after I had written halfway through it that that wasn't the main character, that the most interesting character was actually this girl he meets who's already in town. And I think that this story that's been percolating in my brain from that will feature her as the protagonist watching this new boy move into a haunted house and kind of go from there.
Interesting.
But yeah, I think that's just kind of in the back burner of my mind for, you know, hopefully somewhere down the future. I don't feel like any story you ever write completely goes away. You use pieces of it, or, you know, sometimes you use all of it.
Yeah, that's true. That's so true. And just a sidetrack for one more second, just because
sure.
You mentioned the School of Virginia. Is that where you met Rebecca when you went out there? Because we have to give a shout out to Rebecca Lowell. If everybody has been listening to the bonus episode, she was on recently. Refer back a few episodes ago. And that's how we got Cassie. So yay for Rebecca.
Yes. Thank you, Rebecca.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I overlapped with Rebecca for several years, several summers. And the way that Holland works is you do some coursework online, but mostly you do you do very intensive 6-week courses, you know, every summer. So we go out there and just live, you know, mostly live all together and take these courses and just eat together and, you know, breathe the same air and everything else on this beautiful Holland's campus. And it led to really strong friendships that I still have, you know, critique partners and just amazing writing people, Rebecca being one of them, of course.
Yeah, amazing. So now looking, so the book that's coming out after The Ink Dries, this is your first novel, right? Okay, and this is YA. So how did that shift happen? That you went from middle grade, YA, and also we'll have to tell a little bit what the book's about, because it's heavy material that you're covering. This is like a real serious topic that you're focusing on.
Absolutely. So I was in a writing class about giving voice to underrepresented audiences, and it wasn't my first summer, but it was the semester after my first summer. So that fall summer, I was taking an online class with this amazing professor named Hillary Hamzy. And we read all sorts of amazing stories about bullying and suicide and disability and mental illness and child trafficking and like all of these really heavy things. And it really opened my eyes up to what is like, quote, allowed, what you're allowed to write about. And so many of these stories moved me so deeply. And at the time, all these news articles were popping up everywhere about these young high school age women getting assaulted at parties and many going on to attempt or even succeed at committing suicide. And it was absolutely devastating to me to hear about that. It was such a pandemic, for lack of a better word, that this was happening, and that, you know, young women were quite literally losing their lives over it.
Wow.
So I just thought, what would it be like to be in high school now and to wake up to this sort of violation, mainly being stripped and written on and humiliated like the protagonist in my book? And even if it's not conventional rape, or at least as we normally define it, this is obviously a violation.
Yeah.
And what would it be like if it were someone that you knew who did this to you? And what would it be like if there were someone you really liked and who you believed really liked you back who did this to you? And so during this class, I think it was during a free write or something, I wrote that first scene of Erica, which ended up being the first chapter in my book. It's still very much the same to the first draft that I wrote it, of her waking up after this house party, and she's hungover, and she's confused, and she's disoriented. And the last thing she remembers is making out with her new boyfriend, and then she wakes up to find that she's half clothed and covered in Sharpie. And, you know, we're talking crude, demeaning words and images in intimate places on her skin. And, you know, not just that. There are names. These guys have written their names on her.
Okay.
It's her new boyfriend's name. And, you know, his lacrosse teammates. But also, as she's devastated to find even her new boyfriend Thomas's name. And it was so interesting to me because I started to write this book and I was writing just from Erica's point of view. And at one point I got stuck. And then I realized that there was a second point of view in this book, and that was Thomas's. So of course I'd be remiss to talk about writing the story without mentioning that, you know, I included Thomas's view, which, to be honest, I've gotten a little bit of pushback on, and I totally get that. But I didn't write Thomas's point of view in there to give voice to a potential perpetrator. I wrote Thomas in there because I didn't see many books out there that have a story about assault from the male's point of view,
right,
without him being portrayed as a total monster.
Right.
And I'm not saying that portrayal of total monster is right or wrong. What I'm saying is that I don't believe that any young man who picks up a book like that is going to see himself in that portrayal. He's going to say, whoa, that's so awful. Or at least I would hope he would say that.
Yeah.
But he's also, you know, going to say that could never be me. And I think that that's really damaging and an opportunity is really missed there. So I wanted to write a book where the violation is not only the humiliation of what these boys did to this poor girl, but also that someone who purports to really like and care about someone participates in something so awful and unforgivable. And how does that, quote, nice guy come to reconcile with about himself? How does he own up to it? How does he own up to the fact that even if, once again, this isn't, quote, rape in the conventional way that we know, that this is assault, that this is serious, that this is unforgivable? And I even had some editors say that I should remove his point of view or even make him not culpable in the end, but I couldn't do it because that wasn't the story I was trying to tell. The story I was trying to tell is, how does a young girl live on in a body in which choices have been taken from her, and how does a young man own up to these unforgivable actions, you know, especially ones he didn't believe himself capable of committing in the first place?
Right. Well... Wow. So do you see, is his voice like a warning, or I'm just showing this and you draw your own conclusions?
I feel like I wanted to put the voice of a nice guy who genuinely thinks he cares about this young woman out there, and I wanted to just let it sit. And so however that lands, I just hope that we can open up the conversation, you know, that we can create some space for some nuances to have really difficult conversations, and, you know, also to sort of have this gray area of what is sexual assault and what even something that's like, you know, to some people might seem like a prank, writing on someone while they're drunk, haha, so funny, how that can be deeply devastating and humiliating to someone.
Right, right. Especially once it's not, I mean, it should be done, but it's not the same as just drawing something on the palm of someone's hand. It's not the same thing.
Exactly.
So you mentioned that some editors that necessarily didn't like it. So how did this book then find a home? You go from, you're in the courses, you start to write this book, and all of a sudden, you know, we're counting down the days now to publication. So how did you get from one place to the other? Like, Was there an editor who said, I love it, or you have to convince that editor, or your agent had to convince the editor? How did that work out?
Yeah, absolutely. So do you want me to talk about how the book landed with an editor, or how it landed with an agent?
Well, let's do both. Yeah, let's start with the agent, and then we'll go to the editor. Assuming that's the order it happened in, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So I consider my query process both long and lucky.
Right.
Long in that it took over a year after sending my book out to sign with an agent, but lucky because it's my first complete book and it only took a year to sign with an agent.
Oh yeah.
So I came out of Holland University with a full manuscript, because that's what's required to graduate. That's your thesis project. And then I had graduated from Fullerton and moved cross country to New England, but I hadn't graduated from Holland yet. I took a full year to complete the last coursework, mostly focusing on writing my thesis. And I revised.
Oh, yeah.
And even from my final thesis, the one that I turned in, this book has changed a lot.
Right.
And even after I submitted it as my thesis, I still took several months to revise it. And then finally, I decided that it was going to query. And I had so much enthusiasm and so much support for this book from others. You know, it won a few awards. People were telling me how amazing it was. And, you know, all of that I really kept close to my heart. And it really propelled me forward and with that momentum. But everyone kept telling me it would get sold so fast,
yeah.
Which I think is a very kind thing to say, but I also think it could be detrimental because, as we all know, nothing in publishing happens fast.
Yeah. Kind but not helpful, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, that's what I was expecting. But when months went by after I had started querying and slowly the rejections were trickling in, I started to think that maybe there wasn't something right with this story. Something was flawed. And I got a couple of very kind personalized rejections, which is when it's not just like a dear author,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We don't like your book.
Yeah.
It's a dear Cassie, I love this book. I connected it with in this way, but these are the ways I didn't.
Uh-huh.
And so what I realized was that Thomas's storyline was flawed. That's what I kept getting. I ignored the people who said Thomas doesn't belong in this book or anything like that, because I firmly believe that he did. I just felt like I had to do a better job of making his point of view come across in the way that I wanted to, because it wasn't landing.
Right.
So what I finally realized was I hadn't given him enough to lose if he chooses to do the right thing and tell the truth about what happened. His storyline needed to be stronger.
Uh-huh.
And also, originally, he tells the whole backstory of their, you know, blossoming romance. And so his timeline only caught up with hers in the beginning. And then I went to this writing retreat where I met an incredible editor who I'm indebted to, named Rebecca Aronson. She since left the business, but she,
aww,
at the time was at Harper. She was really excited about this other book that I was working on. So she asked if I could send her, you know, anything else that I had completed. And I sent her this book, and she so graciously gave me just a few brief overarching notes. But this was 6 months, maybe even 9 months into querying, and I kept getting all these rejections. So when she said, these are my overarching notes, I jumped on them.
Right.
And then, like, as I started working on them, it was like 2 weeks later, she left the business, and I was like, no. But it ended up being such a godsend, just because she, you know, she gave me these notes. I took these notes. I was able to go back to all of the editors or all of the agents who still had this book and say, you know, I've got these revisions from an editor. Would you like to see the revision when it's complete? And so they all said yes. And
wow.
So then by the time I sent those revisions, I had several agents who were waiting in the wings for me to send these revisions. And
nice.
That changed everything. Because almost instantly I started getting offers, and I ended up with 5 authors, which was one of the most thrilling and stressful weeks of my life.
Yeah. How do you choose? Yeah. Wow.
It was really tough, but you know, ultimately I chose Sarah Crow from Pippin. She was actually in the very first batch of queries that I sent out, and she saw potential in it. But she couldn't put her finger on what wasn't quite working.
Right.
So when I sent her the revised version, she offered almost immediately, and I really felt like she would be the best fit based on her vision for the book, which most aligned with mine.
Uh-huh.
But again, it took a full year and something like 54 total queries and many, many rejections, but also one kind-hearted editor who gave me the most stellar big-picture edit in just a couple of lines that changed everything. And the edit definitely didn't stop there.
Yeah.
My amazing editor, Lisa Abrams, she was at Simon Pohl up until 2 weeks ago. She actually just transitioned over to Random House, but at the time she was at Simon Pohl, which is where my book was acquired. And she gave me an R&R. And for anybody who doesn't know what that is, that's a revise and resubmit. It's saying, I really like this, but can you make these changes for me? And if you can make these changes, I would love to see the revision. But it's kind of a test. They want to make sure that you're going to push those revisions enough and that you will be easy to work with and all of those things.
Uh-huh.
She must have, seen something in the revisions that I sent her, because she bought the book. And most importantly, her notes were stellar. They weren't changing my book. They were making it even better. They were like pushing it closer towards a book in a way that I wanted it to be, but didn't even realize.
Right, right.
So, yeah. But again, that was that whole submission process was a long one. I went out with that book in November of 2018. I got the revise and resubmit in something like February. I revised until May, and then I got the book offer at the end of July, beginning of August. So it was 10 months or something like that.
Right.
So it takes a long time, but I learned a valuable lesson that it's okay if your book doesn't find the right agent right out of the gate.
Yeah.
It's also okay if your book doesn't find the right home straight away. These things take time. It's so worth the wait. And also, if you believe in the story, it stands a really good shot at finding a home, especially if you're willing to listen to the advice. That turns out to be a lot of work.
Yeah.
in revision, but also really aligns with your story and truly makes it better.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Amen. That's fantastic. Well, also, because isn't the book is coming out with Penguin Random House, right? It's not coming out with Simon Pohl. So did your editor took the book over with her?
No, it's actually still coming out from Simon Pohl.
So I saw that wrong. Okay.
What happens when your editor transitions or moves or whatever happens, they will assign a new editor at the house that it was acquired. So because Simon Pohl acquired my book from Simon & Schuster, it stays with Simon & Schuster, and I was transferred to a different editor, although all of the illustrations are done for the book, all of the major edits are done, we just have past pages left to do. So Lisa really, really took care of me and really made sure that the book was complete before she transitioned.
Bro, that's great. Yeah, because sometimes projects fall through the cracks, so that's good.
Yeah.
Oh, and then you just mentioned the illustration. So I was going to ask about that, now you mentioned that. So there are illustrations in the book. So what are they? How did they get there? Why are they? Why are there illustrations?
Absolutely. So the illustrations feature Erica Strange, and she is the alter ego superhero that my main character, Erica Walker, draws.
Uh-huh.
They feature, they also feature a bat sidekick named Sparky, which I am enamored with. But, Erica draws her, this Erica Strange character, as the best version of herself, as the badass version, as the one who's brave, as the one who can do things that Erica doesn't think she's capable of. But I feel like what Erica comes to realize is that she's already a badass. She just doesn't know it yet. And, as Erica Strange is coming into her superhero powers through the 16 full-page illustrations that are spread throughout the book, Erica herself is finding her own strength and, maybe borrowing some from Erica Strange in the process. But what's really cool about these illustrations, I just got to see them, the finalized version last week. And like I said, there's 16 full pages of these graphic novels sort of spread throughout that are telling Erica Strange's origin story.
Wow.
But they're drawn by this incredible UK-based comic artist named Emma Vaselli. And she's done incredible work with companies like DC Comics and Dark Horse and such, and she just did such an amazing job bringing what my vision of Erica Strange was to life while also putting her incredible and unique spin on it. So how it works is I wrote the storyline. You know, I had to learn how to structure the layout of a comic book.
Yeah.
With numbered pages and so many panels per page and limiting each panel to one action so that it flows and adding in narration blocks and dialogue tags and all of that. And then, you know, that was sent to Emma and she drew it and just made it above and beyond incredible. So yeah, amazing. When I saw the final illustrations, I will admit I cried. Perfection. And they're just so moving to me. And there's so many metaphors in them that really parallel and tie back to Erica's story. As you know, in the dark night of the soul for Erica Strange, it's also Erica Walker's dark night of the soul. And, you know, all of those things just sort of, in my opinion, just really, really complement each other.
So this idea of adding the graphic, to add in the illustrations, did you sell the novel? That idea was already there? Is that an idea that was developed as you're working, once you already got the agent and you're already working on it? Because if you're not drawing it, how does that work? Oh, I have this novel, and by the way, I think it would work really great with illustration. Or how do you approach that?
Absolutely. So you sort of write it out like a movie script. It's very like dialogue tag and description and, you know, all of that type of thing. You have to kind of like lay out the page. The idea came to me in one of my final tutorial classes at Holland, like the last stage in, you know, making sure your thesis is what you want it to be before you turn it in type of thing.
Right.
And because of that, I really wanted the illustrations to be in there. To me, it was important, but also you don't want to limit yourself
right
when you're going out on submission.
Right.
So how my agent pitched it, and I think that this was really brilliant, was this is a prose novel with optional graphic novel interstitials.
Uh-huh.
So it really leaves it up to the publisher to say, do we want to spend money on an illustrator? Do we even like the fact that the illustrations are in there?
Right.
And in fact, one of the reasons I didn't go with a different agent is because he wanted to take out the illustration. And they were so important to me, and I felt like so important to Erica's journey of growth and healing that I ended up not signing with him just because of it.
Right.
So, yeah, but my editor, Lisa, she loves superhero stories. She loves comic books. So she was just really the perfect fit. And then it was just a matter of working with an illustrator to make this really, really come alive.
Well, was there an intention that, you know, after the ink dries, that it's not just referring to the ink on the body, it's also her being an artist? Was there any some sort of parallel between those, between the character that somebody draws and her getting drawn upon?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So fun fact about this book is that it actually had a working title, two different working titles, and then this was the final title after I sold the book. So the first title was The Hollow That Remains, but that ended up feeling too bleak.
Yeah.
And then there was Finding Erica Strange, which I really liked, but you're like, is that fantasy? Is that...
Is that
contemporary? What age group is this for? So that one really didn't fit. And then my editor said, you know, we really need to change the title. So I went back and forth with my editor for several weeks, and lists upon lists of possible titles came out. And my husband in the final hour says, what about after the ink dries? And I was like, oh, yeah.
Yay, Ricardo.
Long after the ink has dried.
Yeah.
You know, to which you're like, no, just after the ink dries. So, of course, I wrote down both as possibilities and gathered another long list of titles, and they picked his. And I really love it. You know, as you pointed out, it really does encompass so many aspects of this book. You know, firstly, Erica's passion for comic book animation, and, of course, the Erica Strange illustrations themselves, but also the words written on Erica's body and the trauma that goes with the fallout of after this ink has literally dried.
Yeah.
But then also Thomas's love for songwriting, and in many ways what he stands to lose if he ends up standing up to do the right thing.
Wow. Yeah, no, it's a great title, but also in a way the title also kind of speaks not just about fallout, but I don't know, I'm seeing it that maybe also speaks about moving on, sort of. Is there hope at the end of this? Do we see some sort of, okay, maybe I can get past this, or is it like, now my life is messed up forever? I mean, without ruining the book, were you aiming for some sort of, you know, things happen, but we have to try to find some way to go through it, or what, like, what's the, where are we going with this?
Absolutely. Because of these news articles I was reading where they ended so tragically and finally and permanently, I wanted to respect the fact that something like this could devastate someone to the point of feeling like they wanted to give up.
Right.
But also, what would it mean if that person survived? What would that look like? How do you come back from this? And so I feel like I ended on a glimmer of hope for those that are willing to brave all of the pages to get there.
Well, also, and then just one more question on this. How much detail or how descriptive did you get in the book, either through language or through actual description, versus, you know, I kind of refer to it, so you have to kind of infer what's going on, but you will be able to infer what's going on, or the editor said, don't use this language or that language. How much of that was a consideration?
Oh, it was a huge consideration, because you want to honor the story. You want to show how she's feeling and what she's doing in real time. But then you also, you don't want to be gratuitous for the sake of being gratuitous, or you don't want to be sensational for the sake of being sensational. So you want to honor these moments, and you want to get real, and you want to get deep, and you want to get gritty, because that's what this situation is. But then you also want to find ways to sort of counterbalance that, if that makes sense. So, you know, she does ultimately end up finding out, you know, the complete story, but I feel like it's done in such a way that it's digestible to the reader, that doesn't feel gratuitous to me, while also honoring the story, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think it does. Well, I guess we'll find out more when we actually read the book, but yeah, I think it does, because, you know, you use too many euphemisms, and it's like, don't stop talking to a child, right? But at the same time,
yeah,
you know, you don't want it to be like, well, this is a, you know, only if you can handle the shock, then you can read it, because then that also just narrows down the audience, and not everyone then is getting to understand what this kind of story is. So I guess,
right.
Yeah. Wow, time really went fast. I have so many more questions. so let's just, we'll sort of wrap it up now, even though I don't want to, but wow. Moving forward, are you thinking of writing more? I don't know if you've already started working on other things. Are you thinking that you're going to stay within this, I don't want to call it the trauma genre, or are you, hey, let's try something else next, or what are you thinking or planning on working on and stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like the niche that I personally am drawn to and feel like it really needs a voice, or another voice, because there can never be too many voices when you are hopefully giving hope to survivors of these different types of situations. I feel like my niche is sort of young girl navigates trauma and, you know, works really hard to come out the other side.
Oh, yeah.
So there is that deep, you know, immersion in this is what this world is like. And hopefully for somebody who would maybe be like, well, what's the problem? She was just written on, why can't she get over it?
Right.
Hopefully this lends a deeper understanding to what it is like to wake up to that, what it really does feel like in your body. But then also giving hope to somebody who's experienced that you have options. Like, your only option is not to end your life, that there is hope on the other side of this trauma. And so, you know, my next project it's going out on submission just this week, so Ooh. Hopefully someone will want to buy it.
Yeah,
it's in a delicate stage.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say too much about it, but I will say that it's once again about a young girl navigating, you know, very dark, difficult trauma, and she's caught between several loyalties to her best friend, to her family, and most importantly, to herself. And it really asks the question, you know, at what point does loyalty to someone else mean betraying one's loyalty to herself? But instead of the graphic novel pages, this one has dark standalone fairy tales that she uses to grapple with this different type of trauma, which I really love. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think I'll stay in that genre for a bit.
Yeah, who knows what will be. So here's an important question before we do our like real wrap up. Okay, I have two questions. One's a quick question.
Sure.
The books that you read now, do you read a lot of these trauma style kind of books, or do you read totally out of your genre to either to mix it up or to just clear your mind?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think initially, so I could inform myself of what else was out there. Also, so I could write like the critical paper that accompanied my thesis to place this in the current vein of books that are out in the world.
Right.
I really heavily immersed myself in these darker YA narratives. I tried to see if you could make a story like this middle grade, how far that was getting pushed, how oftentimes this was bumped up to young adult, to young adult too, but also to adult, because you know, it was being sort of censored in that way.
Yeah.
And so I just heavily, heavily, heavily read in this. And then I realized it was not super great for my mental health.
Yeah.
You know, you can't live in this world outside of your writing and inside your writing at the same time. It's just really difficult to sustain. You know, there were parts of this book where I would be writing it and I would cry for my protagonist. I would cry, but it was also crying for all of these young women who had this experience in real life or similar experiences. And so, I started to definitely branch towards softer stories. And, you know, more recently I started getting into things like biographies
and
lighter fantasy and things like that.
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah. And now here's the ultimate question. Did you learn to not be such a crazy perfectionist, or are you still crazy perfectionist? Because you see that once you send a book out, first of all, there's so many edits that happen afterwards, and even once the book's going to be out, I'm sure you'll find something that was like, oh, I guess I could have used this word instead of that word, or you know, versus turning off your brain. I'm like, you did it and it's out, move on to the next thing. Did you learn to not be a crazy perfectionist?
in so many ways
Great.
I feel like I really allowed myself to just play and just, you know, see what the journey has to offer.
Yeah.
And, you know, I started decorating cupcakes just because it brought me joy because I was good at it. You know, stuff like that.
Yay.
And I really get a lot of joy out of discovering new things. But I do feel like I am still somewhat of a perfectionist when it comes to my writing, just because this is such a delicate subject matter, and I do want to handle it with, hopefully with grace and sensitivity and everything like that.
Yeah.
But then I also, I do a really good job of sending it to my agent or sending it to my editor or sending it to my critique partners and just being like, okay, my time is done. Time to take a week off of writing and go play.
Yeah. Good. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting once the book comes out. We'll have to keep track to see how, you know, if anyone has gone through this, how they reacted. It's a whole new journey now once the book comes out. Because there's till the book comes out, and there's a whole journey afterward. So, much to look forward to. Yeah, great.
Yeah.
And now just to wrap up, like we always wrap up, I always ask for the fill in the blank of, I love it when writers, editors, whomever, even readers, do X. And I really don't like it when they do X. How would you fill in those blanks?
Sure. So I chose books, and I said I love it when books find the perfect dream team. You know, mine started with incredible professors like Hillary that I mentioned earlier, and you know, my professors who taught my tutorial classes in the final stages and really helped make this book what it is today. Like my professors Ellen Kushner and Nancy Ruth Patterson. you know, then finding my incredible agent, Sarah, who saw spark in this before it was ready for the world. And then, of course, Lisa, who, you know, acquired it, championed it, and gave it her badass editorial touch. And then my art director, Sarah Creech, who not only designed my incredible cover, I'm so happy with my cover. It just feels like, side note, it just feels like fractured, sort of like trauma, and it's dark, and the colors are just beautiful. She did such a gorgeous job. And then she also sent me a list of all female illustrators at my request so that I could pick from to, you know, wind up with Emma, who has just been incredible for the illustrations and who just made everything come alive. So I love it when books find the perfect dream team. I really feel like so grateful for all of their support.
And your husband, who gave it the title. Yay, Carl!
Yes, yeah. And my husband, who was so supportive 1,000% of the time. So, you know, as you can see, my acknowledgments page is going to be as long as the novel itself. But anyway, the other half of that is it really hurts my heart when books don't always find the support and the champions that they deserve, which you unfortunately see sometimes. But, you know, I won't linger on the sadness because there's so much good in the book world and so much to be grateful for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's very exciting. Much look forward to it. So everyone, mark your calendars for July 2021. And after the ink dries, when is the are the pre-orders happening? Get pre-order when it comes out.
Yes, pre-orders are already available. I know some of the sites aren't working, but you can definitely find it through IndieBound, and you can find it through through Amazon. But support your local bookstore.
Oh yeah. Okay. So pre-order it, and also go to your bookstore and get it.
Yes.
There we go. Yeah, I'll take care. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast today. It's been such a pleasure and such a treat to speak with you. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was my first podcast interview, and it was so fun.
All right. Debut for debut. This is a bonus episode of Oh My Word Podcast featuring Kathy Gustafson. To find out more about Kathy and her work, please visit the link in the episode notes. Keep track of all today's episodes and all the things we're up to, please visit eltechabout.com. Find us on Instagram at OhMyWordPodcast. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time.